We all know the saying, the wheels of justice turn slowly.
I used to know a guy like you back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Clarence Thomas. He got his.
You don't have to call the boy Clarence Thomas. Shit, he ain't that way.
Is it the company's position that its non-defamatory statements cancel out its
such bad timing. We just got a new comforter.
Yeah, actually, about that, I kind of want to keep that comforter. I paid for it.
Oh my God, do I need to get a lawyer?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 618. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How you doing?
I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
Well, I'm just going to assume that by the time people are hearing this, I'm negative. I'm great. Totally cured. Kids are going back to school, I bet. It's all fine. So I'm great.
Birds are singing. There's double rainbow in the sky. Yeah.
And I'm also excited for today's show. And one more quick reminder of our YouTube Q&A that you probably, as you're hearing this, you have just enough time to hop on over to YouTube. You'll see the links in our social. We'll post about it. Reminder, everybody is invited to come watch us, to come interact with us. And by the way, Morgan Stringer usually comes along, hangs out in the chat. That's always fun. She's hilarious. We get her quips along the way, and we interact in the chat a little bit. Patrons, of course, are the only ones who get to ask the questions, and that's on the Patreon thread that Andrew drew up already. And just another reminder to vote on the questions you want to hear Andrew answer. That's the best way to get the best show out for you, I think.
Absolutely.
A little bit democratic. Not 100%. There is the Thomas Electoral College. You know, I get to, I'm a little bit of an electoral.
We're a republic here at Opening Arguments, not a constitutional monarchy.
So we'll see you all Tuesday, August 2nd, which might be like right now, at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. All right, on with the show.
Wrong, sir.
Andrew Torres
is wrong.
So we got Andrew was wrong. Yeah, this is an interesting one. Actually, there were enough emails and comments and stuff that I saw this too. And Andrew, talking about the Secret Service texts, we did get a number of tech people who were like, nah, this actually seems like it could just be an accident. What did you think about this?
Yeah, I thought longstanding patron Chris Kaiser, who I think is in the field, put it this way, and I'm going to read it despite beginning with, hey guys, Andrew was wrong, which is, you know, is the best way into my heart. Andrew is wrong to treat the probability of unintentional data loss as negligible in OA 615. Okay, so if that's the claim, I'm on board with hearing it. Chris says, TLDR, Andrew's substantive point is already well supported without the sufficient but unnecessary support of poorly developed technical evidence. I certainly agree with that. In other words, I was drawing an inference based on the rather suspicious timing of the event. And Chris's point is, okay, well, you don't need, if you're going to draw that inference, you don't need to also have a discussion about the likelihood of a technical failure, because that's already the null hypothesis. So I agree with him on that. Okay. Andrew is correct if he is describing the probability of an end user accidentally erasing data with a backup. And I think that was kind of my mindset, right? This is somebody who, the viewpoint of someone who doesn't work in IT, and I agree with that, right? The probability that the end user erased that data is zero.
Yeah, there
you go. The end user wanted to intentionally erase that data, then there would be an increased probability that they successfully erased the data proportionate to their level of access to the backup drives. However, erasing data is about preventing recovering of any usable data intended for erasure. Because of the massive scale and complexity of the U.S. government's backup operation, data loss from accidental deletion won't happen, but incidental loss of the data will still happen. Data can still be lost due to corruption, drive failures, network errors, etc. Those can result in isolated losses where only some of the data is rendered totally useless. In terms of the Secret Service texts, assuming they're all government phones, the probability that the relevant text would be lost incidentally is very low, likely a small fraction of a percent. That small chance is only negligible if the effect of bias is also negligible. We have to consider how likely it would be that any significant document relevant to 1/6 would have been lost incidentally. We also have to consider extenuating circumstances on that day that may have increased the probability of incidental data loss for that medium. That is a strong point. None of this is to say that Andrew is substantively wrong about the text being intentionally destroyed or hidden, but the technical support for the argument is a lot harder to develop than Andrew implies. I can endorse that. I think that's good. Ultimately, we know the probability of incidental loss could be extremely high, but that probability is independent of the probability of someone attempting to erase those records. The technical argument may be sufficient in itself to support Andrew's argument, but his argument is supported by a lot already from what we know of Trump's past behavior obstructing and hiding information. And I think that that division is correct, right? Like if you're thinking about it in a Bayesian sense, like, yeah, what is the prior probability that criminals who have spent an entire presidential administration covering up crimes tried to cover up this crime? High, but that doesn't have anything to do with the technical stuff, right? That's independent of, boy, could it be the case that a server was kicked over by a dude wearing goat leggings on January 6th? Yep. Absolutely. So that, I think, fairly summarizes. We had a couple of emails on those.
And, certainly the most complicated way of putting it. I just saw some that,
I love it.
You know, are like, no, actually, there's plenty of ways that this could have been accidental deletion. And as that email points out, though, I think this is consistent with what I was saying based on my very limited experiences. It's not the end user. It's not an individual Secret Service agent like deleting something or throwing his phone away, because that doesn't do it. There's backups and all that, but there could be some sort of like, oh, there was an update in a server, blah, 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 you know, some combination of things. So I don't know. How do you feel about how does this very complicated email and Bayesian, how does that update your Bayesian prize? What's your percentage on accident versus intentional?
Yeah, I think you can restore that there was a, in other words, I interpret Chris's argument as this. If you took the entire modern history of White House record keeping, right? Let's say that stems back to the George W. Bush administration, right? 2001 to the present, and said, what is the likelihood that there is a day or 2 days or a reasonable gap of time in which all the records, in which all of a relevant subset of records have been lost, but for non-nefarious reasons? I can get on board with, oh, hey, that's a much bigger probability than you thought. And so then what you do is you just weigh that prior probability with the question of, now, what is the likelihood that that crazy random happenstance happens to be the day of the insurrection? And you have to discount for the point that Chris makes in the middle, which is the events of the insurrection may be a confounding factor. It may be that the people responsible for running the backups were a little otherwise occupied that day, right? Like there are lots of the, so not knowing that, that's not information any of us have access to at the moment.
Yeah.
So we have to set that aside. Now we just have to compare, well, what's the likelihood that this just, that that date happened to coincide with January 4, 5, 6 versus the prior probability of we're dealing with bad actors, which hasn't changed. We know we're still dealing with bad actors. So that's how I think Chris comes to his conclusion of, hey, you should adjust upward the likelihood that this could have been an accident a lot, but now that just places a tremendous value on the timing. Okay, sure, but it seems awfully suspicious.
Yeah. So you haven't answered my question. What's your percentage? What is your percentage? What do you think?
This still seems very suspicious to me. I have moved upwards the possibility that it is unlikely, but to me, it's now a sort of like, if I were to subpoena records from a party and they said, oh man, I'm sorry, like our basement flooded, right? Like, okay, basements flood, but sure. Like, you know, what's the likelihood that it flooded only at this particular time and exclusively at that particular time, such as to deny us all access to those records? But that's not disclaiming the probability that basements do flood. So that's how I think about it.
Now. Permission to treat the witness as hostile. Will you please just give me a percent, Andrew? Are you 100%? Are you 80?
Fine, I'm 99. How about that?
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. Well, that's useful. I really didn't know. Like what? Because I from the comments I saw, you know, it gave me more doubt than I think you have. I was like, oh, maybe I'm like 50-50 accident versus intentional now. So that's okay. Interesting. I'm glad you put a percentage to it finally.
90, 95. I don't know. High okay. Night. Beyond a reasonable doubt, which I say.
That it's nefarious.
No.
Really? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah. All right. That's well, we'll get more emails.
Yeah. I can't wait.
Down. Down. All right, Andrew. It's time for the OA breakdown of a case that I think has been scaring a lot of people. Uh-huh. This is something that the Supreme Court granted cert on. The case is Moore v. Harper. This is the kind of case that's really going to test whether or not states can, I don't know, steal elections on a presidential level. So, whew, let's have the breakdown.
Yeah, you are hearing this in the context of stealing the 2024 election, which there is a reason, and I'm going to explain that. I want to tell you that although that's a risk, I can't believe I'm going to say this, it's not the biggest risk of this decision. Like,
oh,
this
wow.
decision could be worse than that. So if you're asking, you know, if you want to play The Simpsons, like, would you say this is a good time to panic? Yes, I would, Kent. Like, would you say this is a good time to crack open each other's skulls and drink the delicious goo inside? Yes, I would, Kent, right? Like, this is really, really bad. And I'm going to explain the argument or what passes for argument in Federalist Society
There's
circles.
There's no chance that they granted cert to actually do a good thing? Like, hey, no, this is, we better give a firm answer to this.
Oh, no, there is none because this case is an exceptionally bad procedural vehicle. Now, I will tell you, the argument is so terrible that it is possible. My kind of calibration for when is the Supreme Court going to surprise us, right? Baseline condition is you have to shame John Roberts. That gets you to 4 votes. And then you have to find a legal issue that Brett Kavanaugh or Neil Gorsuch cares about. And so, you know, for example, with tribal sovereignty, we almost had that for a fleeting moment. And then it wasn't enough to embarrass John Roberts anymore. And so then you had, you know, Gorsuch joining the liberals. It's a super high idiotic bar. It is possible, if you are looking for a sliver of hope, it is possible that this argument is so terrible that it loses either Gorsuch or Kavanaugh. Alito, Thomas, and Barrett are just, they do not care. They no longer pretend to care. And Alito has already signed on to this theory in the dumbest way possible. So there are already 3 votes for it, and there likely are at least 2 more. But let's walk through it. Here is from where the arguments. I'm going to read to you Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution of the United States. And then I'm going to ask you a simple question. And because you're not a crazy person.
I love simple questions.
Yeah. So, Thomas, noting that it says, right, times, place, and manners of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. Now, do you interpret? So suppose the legislature says, okay, we're all going to vote and black people can vote for 2 hours from 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. on Sunday, November 5, and white people can vote for 3 weeks from the end of October through Election Day. Would you read this clause for federal offices, for election to the U.S. House of Representatives and to the U.S. Senate, would you read this section as saying that plaintiffs would have no cause of action to challenge
that law?
Oh, like
just
law?
That one little clause would be, well, it says moops, so therefore there's nothing you can do about, no matter how outrageous the legislature might be, nothing anyone can do about it. Is that
correct?
That's the softball
that
you're teeing up
that
for
is
me.
The softball.
So I'm
going to
say,
that
no, that's not how I read it, Andrew.
So what you're saying is when you see in each state by the legislature thereof, you view that as the ordinary way in which human beings have used to describe how laws get passed and not as
forever.
Implicitly implying with no review by anyone ever for any reason, so help you God.
Is there anything at all ever in any of the texts of our country, of our laws, of our anything that you would read that way?
That is an awesome question that I want you to put a pin in, okay? Because that is at the core of this, okay? So we will get back, but yes. So now I've just established for our listeners the common sense of the Thomas takes the bar exam approach of you read, yeah, the rules get to be passed in the state by the legislature. That is subject to all the ordinary constraints on the state legislature that we have, because that's how language works. And suppose you are a Federalist Society, but a Federalist Society member who has a teeny tiny particle of conscience remaining in your head. And you say, okay, but I'm concerned if this is consistent with what the framers thought when they were. So, you know, really, what would John Adams have interpreted that to mean? Uh-huh. I can answer that for you, because we
have him. We got him on the, all right, John Adams, Skype him in.
We shouldn't have to, but remember, we have non-conservative originalist theorists like Akhil Reed Amar at Yale Law School, the most prominent, you know, sort of quirky originalist who, you know, I would describe as a kind of center-left, a brilliant mind. But again, prior to the Supreme Court being taken over by fringe elements, I was opposed to his scholarship. Now it's useful, because now you have to speak crazy when you are answering a cert petition, right? So, okay, now we have to speak crazy, and we have to know, in 1789, what did guys in powdered wigs who thought that women shouldn't be able to own property, what did they think a state legislature meant? And as it turns out, they thought the same thing we think right now, right? Which is,
weird.
I'm going to read you directly from Akhil Amar's Law Review article, quote, "The public meaning of state legislature was clear and well accepted. A state legislature was an entity created and constrained by its state constitution," end of quote. Now, normal people, judicial history, the almighty framers, everybody agrees that prescribed in each state by the state legislature means, yeah, the state legislature gets to make the rules. Can they make any rule they want? Of course not, unless you subscribe to the independent state legislature doctrine, which has at least one public member, which is Samuel Alito, in denying the motion, in his dissent from the Supreme Court's denial of a stay in this case, said, well, they specifically use the word legislature here. They don't just say state. So we have to accord that special weight, because the founders wouldn't have said legislature if they had just meant the state itself. Okay. Now, if you're asking this again as a normal person, that argument is cited, by the way, in the cert petition only to Alito's dissent from the denial of a stay, because nobody before Samuel Alito has ever made that argument before, but the Supreme Court does not care. This is why this case is so significant, and I want to expand it out in this particular way. Yes, this could lead to hijacking the 2024 presidential election in a way, by the way, that the petitioners explicitly tee up, because otherwise Clarence and Ginny Thomas are not that bright, and I think they might not have gotten the, hey, this is how we steal the election in 2024. Leaving that aside, I want you to think about the role between the U.S. Supreme Court and state Supreme Courts. So we have the Dobbs decision. It's terrible. It's awful. One of the things that we can say is, okay, the howler monkeys on this Supreme Court are free to say that abortion is no longer found in the 1st, 5th, 9th, and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. But that cannot stop a state Supreme Court from ruling that, yes, it does. And even if the state constitutional language is identical in pari materia with the U.S. Constitution, they can say, oh, yeah, well, guess what? We are, and we covered this in episode 276, the state of Kansas looked at the state's equivalent of the 14th Amendment and said, you know what? Notwithstanding whatever the Supreme Court does, and gosh, why would we think that 2 years from now the Supreme Court is going to overrule Roe v. Wade? You know, who could possibly see that coming, Susan Collins? That the state of Kansas can say, as a state Supreme Court, interpreting the language of the state Supreme Court Constitution, we are sovereign. And we have decided that the state Supreme Court language means that, yes, it does include protection for the right to an abortion.
We have decided we're going to interpret laws not as idiots.
Right. Yes.
We're taking a weird approach, but, you know, we're Kansas. We get to do it.
And that can be in the text of the opinion. And basically it is in these cases that depart from reading in pari materia with federal courts. It will say in the language, like, we don't think that decision was well-reasoned.
Yeah.
That is a long-standing state power. Let me give you a perfect example. Suppose two different states pass an identical gun control statute, Maryland and Pennsylvania. Right? They're neighboring states. The Maryland statute could be worded identical to the Pennsylvania statute, and the two Supreme Courts could interpret that those statutes differently. And yeah. Both states would be free to say, well, notwithstanding the fact that our sister state in Pennsylvania interprets it X way, we think the better reading is Y. And you could not go to the Supreme Court and say, we want to force Maryland to adopt Pennsylvania's.
You can't even be, even if you try to take like some, I don't know, sympathetic way of saying like, okay, I think it's unfair that like two people who are equal in every way, but they happen to live across this imaginary line, get the law applied differently to them. Doesn't matter.
Because it's not the same law being applied differently. You could if there were an equal protection challenge, right? A 14th Amendment equal protection challenge, but it's two different laws. It doesn't matter that the two different laws are phrased the exact same way. The founder's intent, right? The framer's intent would be, yeah, well, if you don't like it, don't go to Pennsylvania. No one's forcing you to go to Pennsylvania. You go to Pennsylvania, you avail yourself of Pennsylvania's laws. Go to Maryland, you avail yourself of Maryland laws. And therefore, with respect to the interpretation of state statutes and state constitutions, the state Supreme Court has the last word. Could you imagine the contrary? Something where the state Supreme Court could rule, hey, we think our state constitution protects the right to an abortion. And then the U.S. Supreme Court could take up that case and be like, no, Kansas, no, it doesn't anymore. That truly is the level of, you know, okay, well, now it's time to start thinking about leaving the country. You are now no longer free to do the thing that we've always said backstops. Or what if Trump wins in 2024? Well, I love our folks who are in purple states, in red states, and fighting the good fight. I couldn't blame you if you're a woman, if you're trans in one of those jurisdictions saying, gosh, I guess it's time for me to move out. But now imagine if moving out isn't a cure. If every time California passes a law or amends their state constitution, the Supreme Court could strike it down.
Yeah, you wouldn't even have a state constitution then. Like what would it?
You would have it insofar as this activist Supreme Court does not want to disturb it, but you would not have it beyond that. Hey, everybody, this is an ad for Moink, and you know, if I'm doing the ads, that means I'm probably talking about meat. Moink, they're the subscription box company. They work with family farms and independent Alaskan fishermen to deliver grass-fed and grass-finished beef and lamb, pastured pork and chicken, sustainable wild-caught Alaskan salmon, and, as I have told you about from the very beginning, the best bacon you'll ever eat directly to your door. You know I love their food. We also love their values. They're run by an 8th-generation female farmer. Their animals are raised humanely. Their employees are paid a living wage. And that difference is a difference you can taste in the product. Unlike the supermarket, Moink gives you total control over the quality and source of your food. You choose the meat delivered in every single box. You get ribeyes, salmon fillets, that's what I got last time, and so much more. My Moink ribeyes were thick, well-marbled, delicious. Here's what I did. Salt, pepper, garlic powder all around. Sous vide 125 Fahrenheit for 2 hours, then reverse sear in a ripping hot iron pan. Finish with some butter, maybe a little bit of garlic. Oh man, they were just delicious. Plus, you can cancel your Moink box at any time. If I didn't love this food this much, I would not say, oink, oink, I'm just so happy I got Moink, but I do. It's really, really, really good stuff. So, you want to join me in stating their catchphrase in eating the best bacon, really great meat, sustainably farmed from family farms. Keep American farming going by signing up at moinkbox.com/OA right now. And listeners of this show will get free filet mignon for a year. That's 1 year of the best filet mignon you'll ever taste, but only for a limited time. moinkbox.com/OA. That's moinkbox.com/OA. moinkbox.com/OA. You'll thank me.
This show is brought to you by Upside. From cringing at the pump to getting an eye-popping check at your favorite restaurant, inflation is hitting us all where it hurts, and it really hurts. That's why I started using Upside. Upside is an incredible app for anyone who buys gas, groceries, or dines out. And to me, that sounds like everyone, literally everyone. With every purchase, I'm earning cash back thanks to Upside. The app is really easy to use, and I know it sounds too good to be true, but it really isn't. I use it. I am known to be an avid consumer of fast food. I use Upside at my favorite fast food restaurants. You should too. Next time you are grabbing some fast food, check Upside. See if you get some cash back. It's free money in your pocket. Here's how you do it. Download the free Upside app. Use our promo code OPENING and get $5 or more cash back on your first purchase of $10 or more. Next, claim an offer for whatever you're buying on Upside. You check in at the business, pay as usual with a credit or debit card, and you get paid. In comparison to credit card rewards or loyalty programs, you can earn 3 times more cash back with Upside. Upside users are earning more than $1 million every week. That's probably why they have a 4.8-star rating on the App Store. So, download that free Upside app and use the promo code OPENING to get $5 or more cash back on your first purchase of $10 or more. That's $5 or more cash back on your first purchase of $10 or more using promo code OPENING.
And if you think that I'm being hyperbolic with respect to that, now I want to tell you about the facts of the case, about what everyone agrees happened, and how that's played out. And so the question that is in front of the Supreme Court right now. And it has to do with North Carolina redistricting and gerrymandering. So, November 4th, 2021, the North Carolina legislature enacted new redistricting plans for the state legislature and Congress. 12 days later, there was a case filed consistent with North Carolina law, right, with a law passed by the legislature, that is North Carolina General Statute 1-267.1A, which is actions challenging the validity of any act that apportions or redistricts state legislative or congressional districts, to be filed in the Superior Court of Wake County and to be heard and determined by a 3-judge panel. So that's what the law says. If you don't like the redistricting, you go to this court and you go before a special 3-judge panel, and that's how you file your complaint that says this redistricting violates the Constitution, the state Constitution. So it happened. 3-judge panel was appointed. There was a week-long trial, and that 3-judge panel, bipartisan, by the way, designated by the Chief Justice, Republican of the North Carolina Supreme Court, 2 Republicans, 1 Democrat on that 3-judge panel. So not hackery, not Democratic hackery, at least, right? Found that the maps were, quote, the product of intentional pro-Republican partisan redistricting, that they were extreme partisan outliers, that the congressional map was more advantageous to Republicans, and we actually went through this case on OA, if the facts are seeming familiar, than 99.999% of neutral maps.
But in fairness, I mean, there's a...
yeah.
There's this not just happens one time yeah. that Republicans gerrymander like this, yeah.
Right. And so the maps, the panel found, were systematically designed to prevent Democrats from gaining a tie or a majority of seats, even if their candidates won a significant majority of actual votes. But that 3-judge panel said there was not a remedy that they could craft. So that got appealed to intermediate appellate court and taken up by the state Supreme Court. And the state Supreme Court of North Carolina said, no, we agree with the factual findings. This is ridiculous, extremely gerrymandered, and we think we do have relief. And in particular, we think that the decision that we've covered here at great length, the 2021 U.S. Supreme Court decision in Rucho versus Common Cause, which basically said, don't come to us with your problems, right? You solve that through the political process. Go to your states. We're out on this, right? That's what the Supreme Court said in Rucho. Don't bring partisan gerrymandering claims to the United States. Don't file them in federal court. We're not going to listen to them. It's not a justiciable controversy. Well, the reverse part of that is, provisions, quote, quoting from Rucho, and which was then quoted by the North Carolina Supreme Court, provisions in state statutes and state constitutions can provide standards and guidance for state courts to apply. And then the court went on to hold which particular provisions of the North Carolina Constitution and which particular statutes did apply to thus render the gerrymandering claim justiciable under North Carolina law and the North Carolina Constitution, and it issued an order on February 4th that enjoined the use of the gerrymandered map, and then followed up with a full written opinion February 14th, 2022. So this is a uniquely state constitutional right. It is found in the language of the statutes and the Constitution of the state of North Carolina. The court, in particular, the court started with the state constitution's free elections clause, which was added to the Constitution in 1969. So again, no question about what did Plato or Copernicus or John Locke think about this, right? 1969. We can dig those people up. Some of them are still alive. This clause, quote, has no analog in the federal Constitution. It is one of the provisions that makes the state constitution more detailed and specific in the protection of the rights of its citizens. It was derived from a clause in the English Bill of Rights of 1689. I know we thought we were going to keep the 17th century out of it, but nevertheless, which was adopted in response to the king's efforts to manipulate parliamentary elections by diluting the vote to attain electoral advantage. The court concluded that this clause protects the people's right to fair and equal representation in the governance of their affairs. So that should be the end of it.
Case closed.
The North Carolina Supreme Court says, North Carolina law, as understood and administered and interpreted by us, the Supreme Court of North Carolina.
It's in the name.
Yep. Says we have a claim for partisan gerrymandering. This is partisan gerrymandering. Go back and fix this. So remand it back down to the three-judge panel with instructions for the legislature to come up with something different. Well, the legislature came up with some different stuff for the state races that met with bipartisan approval. But when it came to the federal congressional districts, did not want to give up their advantage. And so they came up with another gerrymandered map that was designed to keep North Carolina red, despite the fact that Democrats could win at a statewide level, that went back to the courts. And the trial court looked at that and was like, come on, guys, you didn't even try. Like, the state Supreme Court said your last effort was gerrymandered and you, like, you know, changed these six people. Knock it off. The legislature was like, yeah, no, well, we stand by our map. And so the trial court did a thing that again, this is going to be misconstrued by the Supreme Court. But the trial court did a thing that was the most deferential to the legislature. It said, I am not going to accept, we are not going to accept the counter maps proposed by the plaintiffs here, because they're beginning from a different starting point. We're going to start with the map that the legislature provided. We're going to do our very best to honor their intent, but we're going to have that be modified by our court-appointed neutral experts to comply with the Supreme Court's decision to not gerrymander for partisan advantage. So that's what they did. They worked with these special masters and the experts, and they drew up an interim plan for the 2022 congressional elections. All of this explicitly permitted by North Carolina law. Again, more deferential to the legislature than what the plaintiffs wanted, which was, look, judges, you gave these guys multiple bites at the apple. They've thumbed their nose at the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court. They're clearly not going to draw a fair district. Let us draw the districts. The following North Carolina law, the 2-1 Republican panel was like, no. We're not going to let you guys draw the districts. We're going to still stick with the biased Republican North Carolina legislature, but we're going to fix it as best as we can by relying on experts. And that was then appealed back up to the North Carolina Supreme Court. North Carolina Supreme Court signed off on that. That is the plan that will be used for this 2022 election. So a much more fair plan, an opportunity, again, an environment that's probably pretty bad for Democrats. At least the thumb is off the scale for two congressional districts in North Carolina. So that's a good thing. That is what led to the filing of this cert petition. And the argument that is being made is the state Supreme Court had no power to intervene with what the legislature created because of that idiotic reading that no one could possibly have of Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution. And if you think I'm being hyperbolic here, I'm going to read to you from the memorandum filed by the National Republican Redistricting Trust. Okay? So this is Republicans in charge of redistricting telling you what they would like to do in connection with the cert petition for this case. Quote, some state and federal judicial bodies occasionally take liberties and move from applying election regulations to modifying them or creating new ones. Doing so, however, amounts to unconstitutional usurpation of the legislative power from the legislatures. Article 1, Section 4 exists to stop those encroachments in their tracks. Now, never minding, right, that the judicial usurpation here from the legislature are where they have specifically been designated by the legislature, that, you know, these are subsequent laws. They are arguing, and again, this is how this plays out. They are arguing that the U.S. Supreme Court should come in and tell the North Carolina Supreme Court that it may not issue a binding opinion on North Carolina law and the North Carolina Constitution that applies to the North Carolina legislature. That is a power grab on a level that again, I cannot tell you how radically that upsets the balance of federalism in this country. It's why I went through all of the stuff about who gets to appeal what to where and when you stop. It is something that every first-year law student learns. And if you're thinking, oh, okay, well, you know, maybe it's just going to be in redistricting cases, the example that Republicans give, or in fact, you haven't seen my notes. If you were the most evil, pernicious person, what example would you accidentally use in your cert petition, or maybe intentionally use, right, to tell your buddies on the Supreme Court who now no longer give a shit about the law, oh, hey, by the way, this is how to get the right outcome?
The Civil Rights Act?
Oh, good, 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 but close, but no. How about the 2020 election?
Oh, okay. Is mine more evil or less evil? I'm actually... I want to calibrate my evil level for these things. Did I go too far evil or not evil enough?
You went parallel evil? I don't know.
Okay.
Here's what they said in the saying the quiet part loud. Here's what they said. This unfair encroachment was seen when concerns about the COVID-19 pandemic affected the 2020 election. For example, in Republican Party versus DeGraffenreid, the Pennsylvania legislature established an unambiguous deadline for receiving mail-in ballots, and that quotation is cited to Clarence Thomas' dissent from a denial of cert, because again, it's not true.
A dissent from a denial of cert? Is that even anything? What is the status of that dicta? Is it more or less law than a tweet?
It is an indication of what Clarence Thomas thinks.
Okay.
That's it. It is exactly, to answer your question and not be glib about it, it has exactly as much legal force as a Clarence Thomas tweet, if Clarence Thomas were a tweet.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
So, quote, more Thomas, dissatisfied, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court extended the deadline by 3 days, end of quote. Now, it is the citation there, which again means Clarence Thomas's opinion and no one else's, right? Now, the reality is, as with all of these, that these were cases in which executive branch agencies were delegated the authority to craft reasonable regulations, and or there were pronouncements by the governor in the context of a goddamn pandemic as to how to properly implement rules when the baseline conditions involve, you know, people standing a hell of a lot closer than 6 feet from one another. And so, yeah, did they craft specific rules? Of course they did, because we were in the middle of a pandemic and they were expressly delegated that ability to do so by the legislature. And sitting on top of that was the power of the governor to enact reasonable restrictions during a pandemic to protect the general health, safety, and welfare of her citizens. So, by the way, that's what the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania actually said, right? Not what Clarence Thomas thought they said. Back to the cert petition. In so doing, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court usurped legislative power away from the Pennsylvania legislature and rewrote the state's election rules. See also Republican Party versus Buchvar. By the way, that's a Kraken case. 141 Supreme Court 1,2, Alito concurring. A similar situation occurred in Wisconsin, where a federal court rewrote election law in Wisconsin and extended the deadline to return absentee ballots. And again, the citation there is to a Neil Gorsuch concurrence in the denial of the application to vacate the stay. So, this is, again, as you read through the cert petition, with the exception of the argument I'm going to piece together for you, all of these citations are citations to, and generally not even opinions from the past 5 years, dissents, concurrences, things that the howleriest of howler monkeys have written on their most howling days.
Is there a bit of a parallel to the whole, hey, since you paused the Electoral Count Act while there was a, you know, coup, a riot, a violent thing happening, that means that it doesn't actually matter. And you don't have to go through the thing. Is it sort of a parallel there to like, well, because these people made slight modifications to how voting worked when there was a pandemic, therefore that's some massive violation of that power?
I think the logic is the same because, or the logic is similar. Let me not go too far out on the branch. I think you are perceptive in finding a similar logic that is a rough cousin of our sovereign citizen friends, right? The like, no, the important thing is exactly what it says in the text when interpreted in this, so that, you know, if it says deliberation is to last only 2 hours, I'm sorry, that means deliberation is to last only 2 hours. And if you've got a 6-hour gap in which you've been escorted to a state house, well, too bad. That just means the law doesn't apply anymore, right? Like that is nonsense to a thinking person. but I think to a sovereign citizen, they're like, well, yeah, no, of course, that makes total sense. And I think that you are, you know, sort of exposing the folks who are crafting this are not beginning from the same ordinary principles of jurisprudence as, you know, a fairly well-educated comedian who's been answering bar questions for 5 years. So, yeah, that's what they want to invalidate.
This show is brought to you by Buck Mason Clothing. Look, we all have our favorite go-tos, shirts, sweaters, jeans. I work from home, so I tend to wear the same thing every day because I don't really have to go out. And I'll tell you, the thing I wear every day is Buck Mason. Their clothing is incredible. My everyday clothing is virtually all Buck Mason. Their clothes are second to none. They're timeless and never go out of style. Everything I own fits great right out of the box and becomes my new favorite already. And they make all the essentials, jeans, shirts, jackets, and so much more. I love the tailored look and fit of their t-shirts. Even after wearing them and putting them through wash after wash, they look as good as when I first wore them. And that's important to me. A lot of cheap clothing that I've bought in the past really wears out after a couple washes, but not Buck Mason. It's really, really good stuff. It's made with quality, which is just not easy to find nowadays in today's internet order everything, you never know what you're getting society. But Buck Mason is the real deal. The curved hem tee is fantastic. I got a super thick t-shirt from them that I love. The texture is just so nice. And that thing is never going to wear out. I think it could stop a bullet. Not really. I shouldn't make that claim. Once you try Buck Mason, they'll become your go-to as well. Head over to buckmason.com/OA and get 15% off when you spend at least $100. That's BUCKMASON.com/OA to get 15% off when you spend at least $100. BuckMason.com/OA.
Here's how this could play out in 2024. The regulations say the Pennsylvania Board of Elections shall open any mail-in ballot that reasonably bears an indication that was intended by the voter, right? They then promulgate, the Pennsylvania Board of Elections says, okay, what that means is it does not have to have a signature, but so long as it has any marking on the back, we're going to count that ballot. They then go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says, yep, that's a totally reasonable regulation.
Sorry, which Supreme Court? The state Supreme
Court? The state Supreme Court.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's good to ask. Goes all the way up to the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, which says, yes, that's a reasonable application rulemaking of the authority that was delegated to you, the Pennsylvania State Board of Electors. And that means we're going to count these votes. And that means, you know, Joe Biden wins the state of Pennsylvania. That they want for the U.S. Supreme Court to be able to invalidate that decision, declare that the true winner in Pennsylvania was Donald Trump, send the case back to the Pennsylvania courts with instructions to proceed consistent with that finding. And that's why people are terrified. They should be. They have a right to be terrified. But there is so much more than just election decisions that are on the line. And I know, like, that's a horrible situation in and of itself.
Just so I understand, was this an actual ask that they're making in this case? Or was this an example? Because you set it up of like, oh, this is something they cited as an example. Are they actually really asking to change the 2020 election?
They are not asking to change the 2020 election.
Okay.
They are asking to set up conditions that would make it possible for this Supreme Court to, after the fact, decide the 2024 election by just having enough Supreme Court decisions, even if they lose, even if they crack and lose, right? to tee up, because that's what they're citing.
Is how have we not coined that before? Crack and lose. That's what Alex Jones is doing in his trial right now. That's okay.
There you
good,
go.
Good new
added to word the lexicon.
There.
Yeah. Here's how the question is presented. The question is presented whether a state's judicial branch, that is the state Supreme Court, may nullify the regulations governing the manner of holding elections for senators and representatives prescribed by the legislature thereof, quoting Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution, and replace them with regulations of the state court's own devising based on vague state constitutional provisions purportedly vesting the state judiciary with power to prescribe whatever rules it deems appropriate to ensure a fair or free election. Now, admittedly, that's an incredibly stupidly written question. One of the things that the Supreme Court can and will do is rewrite the question presented, but that's the one they granted cert on, right? That's the one that four members of this court looked at and were like, yep, totally want to answer that question. So that's the ask. The ask is constrain the power of state Supreme Courts to review actions by the state legislature, which is outrageous, right? That's the function of a state Supreme Court. And I guess where I would like to sort of end, right, is I want to explain that not only is this a radical departure, not only is this horrible and terrible in every way, but that the legal theory is flimsy even for this Supreme Court.
And that is saying something.
Yeah. And this will go back to the question that you raised. So I told you to put a pin in it. We will pull that pin out in about 60 seconds. The legal theory, and God help me on this, stems from dicta from the Rehnquist concurrence in Bush versus Gore. Now, you may recall that we devoted episodes 1 to 4 of this podcast to the fact that Bush v. Gore essentially didn't count and was the Supreme Court admitting that it didn't count. That Bush v. Gore is virtually never cited. That has changed since 2016 because the most extreme conservatives now believe that they can make hay out of a particular clause in the beginning of Part 2 of the concurrence of an unsigned opinion that every... Okay. Let me read you what Justice Rehnquist said. And again, I could ask the same question I asked at the beginning of the segment. So that begins, the individual citizen has no federal constitutional right to vote for electors for president of the United States unless and until the state legislature chooses a statewide election as the means to implement its power to appoint members of the Electoral College. Article 2, Section 1. That's true. That statement is correct. However, what comes next is what comes next. This is the source for the statement in McPherson versus Blacker, 1892, that the state legislature's power to select the manner for appointing electors is plenary. It may, if it so chooses, select the electors itself, which was indeed the manner used by state legislatures in several states for many years after the framing of our Constitution. See id, that's that Blacker decision from 1892 at 28-33. And now, do you remember what your pin was?
Oh, is there any other places where the law is written this, where you interpret things this way?
And that is the word plenary. Plenary means without limitation. And I will tell you as a lawyer.
Hold on, though.
Yep.
Plenary means without limitation, as in no court, not a single other court in the earth can... challenge what you're doing.
So you've seized on, I struggled with this for a little bit until I came up with the right analogy.
Can't wait to hear it.
Plenary is used in legal writing the same way that literally is used in public writing, right? It's mostly analogistically, right? Like if I say, I am literally peeing my pants with rage, right?
It's like the opposite now.
Yeah. I'm so mad, right? Like, but I'm not.
It literally means not literally.
That's right. And courts have sort of struggled with that, you know, with cases in which people have said, I literally want to murder Thomas Smith. Well, you know, that means I'm really angry with you. Similarly, like when you think of when the legislature meets for a plenary session, well, a plenary session means they can consider more than just the bill that they just passed, right? Like, you know, when they're in closed session, you are debating only a specific proposition. When you're in a plenary session, all the business is on the table. But that doesn't mean there's no limitation on what they can do, right? Like it means, yeah, it's kind of like that, but not, you know. And every example that I looked for in legal writing of the use of plenary power is consistent with that kind of like, well, we mean, but we don't mean nothing, right?
Yeah.
We don't mean zero constraints. The only thing I can find in which there is actual plenary power, right? That is, a thing gets done and there's not a goddamn thing you can do about it, is
this f-ing Supreme Court.
Well, this Supreme Court too. But like, even this Supreme Court, like there are things that you could do about their decisions, right? You can go to your state Supreme Court for now. You can go to your state Supreme Court and pass a state, right? Like it's like nothing is plenary except the presidential pardon power. Right?
Oh, right.
The presidential pardon power, as far as I can tell, is plenary or damn near plenary, right? Like, if it's a valid exercise of power, but you still have to go to court to determine if it's a valid exercise of power. There's nothing where you would say, nope, oh, sorry, the state legislature said it, therefore that's it. Therefore, plenary means there's no further inquiry, no right back to the court. And to prove that reading is not historical, I went back to McPherson versus Blacker. And McPherson versus Blacker, that 1892 case, is actually about the state legislature appointing electors versus holding statewide elections. Right? So here's that section talking about whether the power is plenary or not. And it says, this power, meaning to decide presidential electors, is conferred upon the legislatures of the state by the Constitution and cannot be taken from them or modified by their state constitutions any more than can their power to elect senators of the United States. Whatever provisions may be made by statute or by the state constitution to choose electors for the people, there is no doubt the right of the legislature to resume the power at any time, for it can neither be taken away nor abdicated. Now, that does not say you have zero recourse, right?
Yeah.
That does not say that the state laws allowing popular election of your senators are all of a sudden void. That's just not remotely the case. But now we have the following language. From this review, again, remember, this is the Supreme Court, 1892. From this review, in which we have been assisted by the laborious research of counsel, and which might have been greatly expanded, it is seen that from the formation of the government until now, the practical construction of the clause has conceded plenary power to the state legislatures in the matter of appointment of electors. But I'm not just going to dust my hands and say, okay, case closed for the Federalist Society. I'm actually going to read the next two sentences. Even in the heated controversy of 1876, you know that, the electoral vote of Colorado cast by electors chosen by the legislature passed unchallenged, and our attention has not been drawn to any previous attempt to submit to the courts the determination of the Constitution, the determination of the constitutionality of state action. And here's the critical sentence. In short, the appointment and mode of appointment of electors belong exclusively to the states under the Constitution of the United States. End of quote. So belonging to the states is what Akhil Amar said at our very bit, right? That is very, very different than what is being argued now, which is belonging only to the state legislature with no provision for the state legislature or the state Supreme Court to impose any restrictions on it. Nobody has ever accepted that argument. And again, if we lived in a sane universe, you would just say, oh, Andrew, is there binding Supreme Court precedent from 90 years ago to the contrary?
Yeah.
Of course there's binding Supreme Court precedent from 90 years ago to the express contrary. That's a case called Smiley versus Holm. It is a 1932 case involving a Minnesota law that allowed the governor to veto redistricting efforts. So again, if the independent state legislature theory is correct, that has to be unconstitutional because you can't, how can you give the governor the power to veto something that you can never take away from the state legislature? And guess what? The Supreme Court said that's totally fine. Quote, it clearly follows that there is nothing in Article 1, Section 4, which precludes a state from providing that legislative action in districting the state for congressional elections shall be subject to the veto power of the government, as in other cases of the exercise of the lawmaking power. End of quote. I don't see how you could get any more clear than that. You use the ordinary legislative process. And what else is a part of the ordinary legislative process? That people get to appeal that ordinary legislative process to the state Supreme Court, which is the last goddamn word, not the federal Supreme Court, not the Federalist Society, your state Supreme Court. And that's what they want to take away. And by the way, I would point out that you would, under this doctrine, still get state Supreme Court review of your state offices, just not for federal offices. So it is just mind-boggling, indefensible, clearly outcome-driven. And so if you've been, you know, sort of outraged about this by like memes that you've seen, it's way worse than what you think. So there you go.
Oh, boy. Cool.
Yeah, I'm sorry. There's no silver lining. Wow. There's no this. There's
no
that.
It's almost like we need to elect 50 senators who want to get rid of the filibuster and expand the court, and that's the only thing we can really do.
Yeah, that would be real great right about now.
Sometimes you eat the bar, and sometimes the bar, he eats you.
And now it's time for T3BE. Once again, you know, trying to answer these questions as though the law matters. We have to just pretend that the last year of jurisprudence didn't happen in order to answer these.
Yeah, so Thomas, this was a civil battery case that actually is potentially relevant, in which the plaintiff was suing the defendant after the defendant allegedly tripped while she was walking down the stairs. Plaintiff calls a witness to testify on her behalf. The witness corroborates the plaintiff's story. On cross-examination, counsel for the defendant asks, "Isn't it true you cheated on your CPA exam by attempting to look at your notes during the test?" Plaintiff's counsel objects. How should the court rule on the objection? You said, after thinking about this a lot, you said, "C, it should be overruled because the question regards the credibility of the witness." Differentiating that, I think you pretty clearly stated, from offering character evidence. Mm-hmm. And Thomas, 100% correct. There's some good news in this episode whatsoever. This is a tough question.
I really battled on this one. That was a lot of deliberation.
Yeah, because there is a baseline rule that everyone is familiar with, that every lawyer is familiar with, Rule 404. This is the Carjacker Willie rule, right? This is evidence of a person's character or character trait is not admissible to prove that on a particular occasion that person acted in accordance with the character or trait. So I can't show your Carjacker Willie to prove that you acted in accordance with the trait of being a carjacker. But as you correctly deciphered here, you ask the question, why are they trying to introduce this evidence? They're not trying to introduce evidence that this witness is a serial cheater on exams. Yeah. Right? They're trying to say, this is not the kind of witness that you should believe. And not the kind of witness that you should believe is an attack on the credibility of a witness, which is always valid. So despite the fact that I think the question is worded in such a way to get your sympathies and your kind of common sense first take that, you know,
this seems
really far-fetched. Like you're going to introduce, like, didn't you cheat on this test in order? You absolutely can ask the question. And if you want to think about it a step further, the fact that that would be such a dumb question to ask is, I think, that the reason the rule is the way it is, right?
You let the jury evaluate.
Because the jury is
going to
roll their eyes and be like, really, the worst thing you could say about that was that, you know, she, didn't you once drive 67 in a 60? Yeah, all right, fine. And if the worst that they could do is, you know, you admit to cheating on a test from 20 years ago, then, you know, I would think I would certainly include that in my closing statement.
Then again, that would still apply to lots of other things that wouldn't be allowed, though. That same logic, like, because you aren't allowed. Did I remember correctly that you aren't allowed to just attack the character of a defendant unless they try to put forth the positive? Remembering that?
That is absolutely correct for character evidence. Yes.
Right. Okay. But if I said, but Andrew, I'm only saying that they cheated on their CPA exam and that's pathetic, and so the jury could evaluate that, it'd be like, no, sorry, still can't do that because it's not allowed.
Yep, that is exactly right.
Well, I nailed it. That's amazing. I'm so happy about that. I was really worried. I just couldn't quite.
It's a hard question. I'm very proud of you.
Thank you. I feel great. All right. Well, let's celebrate with also a winner that can be just as happy as I am right now. Who's our big winner for this week's T3BE?
Well, Thomas, I can tell you a lot of people got this one wrong. A lot of people wanted to guess B and did, in fact, guess B. But somebody who did not get it wrong is Mad Political Scientist on Twitter, who writes, "It's C. We're impeaching the witness. If Alex Jones is the only witness, I guess you're basically in international waters." Well, congratulations on getting it right, on having a nice timely Alex Jones dig. Everyone, let's give the Mad Political Scientist a follow. That is at njordan79, at njordan79 on Twitter. And congratulations, Mad Political Scientist, on being this week's winner.
Thank you for being brave.
Oh, yeah.
Travel down the road and back again.
Hey, so we started from the bottom, now we're here, girl.
And now it's time to thank our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats on patreon.com/law. These are the big dogs. We're in the final... Oh! That means you just heard the music. We're in the final, and I think it was quartiles this month, wasn't it?
I think that's right.
The final quartile. We're jamming out to that. All right, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, big thank you to, now that the top patron status is not as sacrosanct as was previously claimed, consider one more minor violation and thank me. That is maybe the best patron name we've ever had.
Congratulations. That's a very good one.
The Patreon mobile app is unbelievably bad. Seriously, they must be taking the piss. I'm sorry. Return of the Karaoke Legend, now playing at your local sweaty dive bar. I'm there. Jonathan, seriously, the live show in Minneapolis. We know. Absion, Milo Meadsong wishes all meteors a happy crash into Justice Thomas's stupid little RV. Perfectly legal for all of us to say. Medicon 7, join your local labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Sergeant Javier Escueda is still awaiting trial in retaliation for whistleblowing the death of a subject in police custody. The most important vote a man can cast is the next one. WordOrigins.org has a new book, From Barflies to Bitcoin, How Words Map Our Modern Era, available on Amazon. This user was traded for a patron to be named later. 2 fabulous bonus episodes.
Yeah.
False. Anonymous. Give to modestneeds.org, then visit deepfakestop.com. I'm Motion in Lemonade. Derek, not that Chris Wallace. Big Easy Blasphemy. Dude, rondothedork.com. Thomas, take it away.
Thank you to Too Much Leaven, the all-Orthodox Jewish Bee Gees tribute band. A string of unpronounceable characters. Malcolm the Dragon, the Precious variant. Malaika Chandler, Tricicular Manslaughter. Liz, Puffy Coats Are Violence. W. Soggy Pants. Chris Waltrip, De Jure Belly at Patchy's At Last, Baby, Heather L., Matthew Vernon, Ian and Allie, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick gets to change his patron name because Patreon gave up on his blog too. Therese Chan, Teresa Gomez, Adam Costa, David in Brooklyn, Sam Danow, Mitchell, Ice Cube or Ice T, I'm not sure, Michael Rops, I agree with that 100%, and sitting in the Conrad Michaels chair for excellence in patronage, top Hall of Famer all time, Sam Buck.
We love you, Sam.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Maybe there's still just enough time to catch us over on our live Q&A on YouTube. That's Tuesday the 2nd at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. Hop on over there right now. If not, we'll see you for a rapid response Friday.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.